Now we turn to another problem with a common diagnostic test, prostate biopsies. Well over a million U.S. men get these biopsies every year. For the vast majority, the test isn't fun, but it's not dangerous either. Still, NPR's Richard Knox reports that doctors are worried about an increasing number of complications that can be sudden and life-threatening.
Like lots of other guys, Tom Hayward's doctor urged him to have a prostate biopsy after a blood test indicated he might have cancer. It's called a PSA test. The biopsy involved firing tiny needles into the prostate gland to get tissue samples. The actual procedure wasn't as bad as Hayward expected.
It went fine. You know, it's not the most pleasant procedure in town, but it's not that uncomfortable, and it didn't take that long.
Next morning, he played tennis, had a full day of meetings, and at 5, he got into his car and headed off to a dinner engagement.
And from that point forward, for about for an hour, I can't tell you, you know, how I got where I did, except I was on one of the three of the busiest expressways in Chicago.
When he didn't show up for the dinner, his wife got worried. Police located his car because it had an onboard navigation system. By that point, Hayward realized he was way off course.
15 minutes later, one of my sons, who's a lawyer here in town, pulled me over and said, "Give me the keys," and called an ambulance and took me to a local hospital.
His doctor, Anthony Schaefer, says a high fever had put Hayward into a mental fog. Hayward's problem, a raging infection.
It can happen very quickly. It's a very sudden and dramatic change in their status.
Hayward's infection was caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria that were present in his gut before the biopsy. The biopsy had introduced these bugs into his bloodstream. Doctors are usually able to cure these infections, but often men require hospital-intensive care and weeks of heavy-duty antibiotics. Now, post-biopsy infections like these are not common, but they're more common than they were a few years ago. That's according to Dr. Robert Nam at the University of Toronto. He did a study of how often Ontario men suffer serious infections after prostate biopsies.
It went from 1% to 4%.
That's a small number, but a huge increase.
A fourfold increase over a 10-year period in hospital admission rates for a diagnostic procedure, I think, is high, very high, concerningly high.
It's happening in the U.S., too. Johns Hopkins researchers did a big study of Medicare patients and found a sharp increase in serious infections. At last week's annual meeting of the American Urological Association, there were no fewer than 10 reports on the subject. One involved Anthony Schaefer, Tom Hayward's doctor. His focus is on preventing these infections. Schaefer and his colleagues at Northwestern University say they've been able to cut infections to zero by checking before a biopsy to see if a man harbors antibiotic-resistant bacteria. If he does, they give him antibiotics they know will knock out the resistant bugs.
The point is that this directive preventive therapy is designed to kill the bugs that are there versus just guessing as to what bugs might be there.
His colleague Robert Nadler says the infection risk is causing a lot of soul-searching about prostate biopsies.
I think this is forcing urologists to really step back and take a look to say, does this patient really need a biopsy? And I think that's what's happening.
By the way, you might be wondering whether Tom Hayward's biopsy discovered cancer.
The good news is the biopsies were negative. The bad news is the end result almost put me in the ground.
A high-priced test.
You're absolutely right. It's a high-priced test.
But if the doctor said, "Tom, you need another biopsy," he'd have one. Richard Knox, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's now time for All Tech Considered. If you're making a summer books list, there's a new title out from an online humorist. His email exchanges with unsuspecting victims have been going viral for years. NPR's Shireen Meraji sat down with the author of The Internet is a Playground, Irreverent Correspondences of an Evil Online Genius.
This email exchange went viral a while ago. Maybe someone sent it to you. In my head, it sounded a little something like this.
Dear David, our records indicate that your account is overdue by the amount of $233.95. If you have already made this payment, please contact us within the next 7 days to confirm payment has been applied to your account and is no longer outstanding.
Dear Jane,
I do not have any money, so I'm sending you this drawing I did of a spider instead. I value the drawing at $233.95, so I trust that this settles the matter. Regards, David.
Basically, this David guy is trying to pay a real chiropractor bill with an elementary drawing of a spider. The woman he's emailing is not amused. The email exchange is funny to some, but to others, David comes off as a bit of a bully.
You reckon it's me?
That's the real David, David Thorne. He's an Aussie.
I never initiate the conversation. If somebody's initiating it, then really it's up to them if they want to end the discussion or whatnot.
But for Thorne, it's best when they keep hitting send. It all started when the chain-smoking, 30-something graphic designer single dad from Adelaide, Australia, was bored at work. He'd instigate email arguments with coworkers, landlords, friends, and school chaplains. He'd write outlandish stories on internet forums that would get him kicked out by irritated moderators. Why? He says it's because it made him laugh.
People use the word troll, but I'm not on there to upset people or anything like that. I'm just basically go on these forums and write little stories. I'm a designer, but it's a lot more fun writing than it is laying out business cards.
Thorne put his funniest stuff on his website, 27b/6.com, and when he posted that spider email exchange, he realized he wasn't the only one chuckling.
Before the spider email, the website was probably getting 500 hits a week. After the spider email was posted, I think it was about 500,000 hits a day, and the servers just collapsed.
Thorne needed a dedicated server, but hosting charges were pricey. So he gathered his online pranks and stories into a self-published book, The Internet is a Playground. A real publisher picked it up, and it recently made the New York Times bestseller list. Thorne is adamant that none of this could have happened if his work didn't make some people laugh and others shake their heads in disgust.
If I post something and I get five comments and they're all, that was funny, that was good and everything, then yes, I'll jump in there under a construct's name and say that was terrible. The guy's an idiot. Because that's the only way to create the factions. Factions are gold. They're just priceless. Been doing that for years. That's terrible, isn't it?
I tried to reach a couple of people in the anti-Thorne faction, but only one got back to me, Shannon Walkley. She was the admin assistant at the branding firm where he worked and a repeat target of Thorne's email shenanigans.
She filed three formal complaints because she didn't like my sense of humor. And I'd steal things from her desk, and I think I just wore her out after a while.
Shannon Walkley declined an interview in an email saying, "Sorry, this is probably just another one of his tricks anyway, and I don't care about his book or his stupid website." So is David Thorne an online humorist or a grown-up bully trolling the web for victims? Either way you look at it, the internet is his playground. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
And you can read excerpts from The Internet is a Playground at npr.org/alltech.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Obama is in Europe this week. He's working on overseas alliances and heading to the G8 summit. Here at home, the race to replace him in 2012 is drawing more attention than his presidential trip. The Republican field keeps shifting. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels bowed out over the weekend, while others jumped in, like former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty. For more on the political landscape this Monday morning, we're joined by our own Cokie Roberts. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, Mary Louise. How you doing?
Great, thank you. So let me ask you about this. A lot of Republicans were very hopeful, keeping their fingers crossed, that Governor Daniels would run for president. Why isn't he going to?
He says it's family reasons, and everybody who knows him says that's exactly right. His wife and four daughters didn't want him to run. They understand, because he has been very involved in national politics for a long time. They know what a presidential race would be like and what the scrutiny would be. There was a period in his marriage where his wife and he divorced. She married someone else. Then she came back. He did issue a statement over the weekend saying the notion that she had abandoned her children was just wrong, that was not true. But they know how tough a presidential campaign would be, and they don't want to do it, particularly given the fact that President Obama is looking pretty strong. So going through all that and then losing, or possibly losing, is really something that, doesn't interest them.
Okay, so that's the decision for Governor Daniels. The other development we mentioned, former Governor Tim Pawlenty says he's in. How at this point should we rate his chances?
Well, he's certainly someone to be taken seriously, but first he has to get through the Iowa caucuses, where he will formally announce his candidacy today after doing a home morning on network TV shows. He scooped his own announcement with a slickly produced web video last night. Give it a listen here.
Together, we'll change our country. And this time, it'll be for the better.
Change. You remember that word from President Obama's campaign. Polanyi's biggest problem is Iowa. He has to win it for him to get the money and the credibility to move on. And his biggest problem there could be fellow Minnesotan, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, should she decide to get in the race, because she has a lot of appeal to those evangelical Christians who show up in huge numbers at the Iowa caucuses.
Well, with this decision by Polanyi, with Daniels out, as we mentioned, it does seem as though the field's maybe starting to gel a little. Is there a clear front runner at this point?
Well, Mitt Romney is not officially in the race, but he's the closest thing they have to a front runner. Newt Gingrich has had a terrible week after he announced. Herman Cain is not a candidate that many people take seriously. Same with Ron Paul. Maybe Sarah Palin will get in. Maybe Michelle Bachmann will get in. And John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah, had a week in New Hampshire last week and is clearly out seeing if he's going to run, and most think he will. Look, there's talk again post-Mitch Daniels of drafting Governor Christie of New Jersey or former Governor Bush of Florida, who said no. I think we see this field now. I think one of these folks, Mitt Romney or Tim Pawlenty or John Huntsman, one of those guys will be the nominee.
Cokie, before we let you go, one other development to ask you about. That is this special election that is going to take place in New York tomorrow to fill a House seat. I gather there's some thinking that this may provide a sneak preview for what Republican nominees on the national ticket may have to deal with if they decide that they want to run for national office.
Well, this is a seat that should be a solid Republican seat. Jack Kemp represented it. It's open because Chris Lee posted pictures of himself with no shirt on the internet, so he had to resign. The Republican is having trouble because of that Medicare vote in the U.S. House, and it's given the Democrat an even shot of winning. Now, if the Republican loses, she'll say it's because there was a third-party candidate in there. If the Democrat, though, will say it's because the Republicans did something very unpopular on Medicare, and that will put fear in their hearts.
Okay. Cokie Roberts, thanks very much.
Commentator and veteran blogger Jennifer Sharp has always looked for the funny and quirky online. This time she found it in the comments of one of her more serious Facebook updates.
I'd been through one of the worst losses an Angeleno can go through. My car got stolen. Humbled, I had to walk to a friend's house for help. But it wasn't until later that night, when I sank into my couch and logged onto Facebook, that my anxiety finally began to subside, thanks to some first responders in my social network.
Holy smoke, my car got stolen.
The first sympathy comes from Jennifer Holmes in San Francisco.
May the thief get swift karma, which they cannot rationalize as anything else.
Next, Randy Mills wants to know.
What kind of car was it?
It's a charcoal 2004 Toyota Matrix with a spoiler. So strange to think it's out there somewhere without me.
Ingrid Heather wants more detail.
From where? Venice. Our last moments together, parked, singing along to Black Coffee in Bed. And when it was actually being stolen, I was probably sipping a cappuccino and thinking about espadrilles.
Don't mean to sound callous, but when things calm down, we may have to discuss espadrilles.
Espadrilles are canvas shoes with rope soles, usually flat, but sometimes made into heels, originating in the Pyrenees.
Did you call the insurance company? How about the cops?
Yes, Randy. I filed a police report. I even have a LoJack. But onto the espadrilles. This woman walked into Cafe Intelligentsia wearing some, and I suddenly wanted a pair of espadrilles. Like, I haven't wanted a pair of espadrilles since 1988. What are your thoughts on the matter?
Well, I love espadrilles, especially navy ones with white pants.
Ingrid Heather continues.
But I've noticed that nobody makes a basic dark navy classic espadrille with a high enough heel. Instead, everyone is riffing on espadrilles.
Have you found ones you like?
No, my quest for espadrilles had been interrupted by my car getting stolen. And where was it now? On some dock in San Pedro being loaded into a shipping container? Erica Hughes speaks to my loss.
Jennifer, I am really sorry about your car. But about the espadrilles, I was thinking about them yesterday.
I'm sorry about the wheels. Maybe this link will cheer you up.
Coco Nyhoff in Amsterdam.
It's the mothership of espadrilles in Europe. It's a Spanish company.
The idea of someone's grubby hands on my steering wheel fades behind collections of espadrilles as my friends succeed in moving me past my trauma. The next morning, I announce,
Hallelujah, they recovered my car. My LoJack prevailed. Everybody, get a LoJack and some espadrilles.
But in real life, it's not that simple. Even though the police did find my car, the perfect pair of espadrilles remains on the loose. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Sharp.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to keep photos, music, and other files safe from computer mishaps. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
We're going to hear from a poet now, Dean Young. His poetry is frank and often has a twisted humor, and many of his poems dwell on impermanence.
Because I will die soon, I fall asleep during the lecture on the ongoing emergency. Because they will die soon, the young couple has another baby. She's not yet out, but it's late enough to see her struggle like a dancer in a big bubble. Because the puppy will die soon, he learns not to pee on the carpet.
That's Dean Young, reading from his newest collection, Fall Higher. His poems can be found in Poetry Magazine and The New Yorker, but there's a particular poignancy to these poems as they deal with mortality, because this book came out last month, just days after the poet received a heart transplant. Dean Young joined us from his home in Austin, Texas, where he's recovering from his surgery. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I gather that you're known for writing every day, but using an old typewriter.
Right. First I write by hand, and then I work on a 1955 Remington Quiet Writer.
Are you writing still every day?
I'm getting back to it. Not with the sort of concentration and gusto that I look forward to in the future, but I am blackening some pages.
Before you received a transplant, a poem came out in The New Yorker called The Rhythms Pronounce Themselves, Then Vanish. Would you read that for us?
After they told me, the CT showed there was nothing wrong with my stomach, but my heart was failing. I plunked one of those weird $2 T-balls I bought in Chinatown, and it bobbed and bloomed like a sea monster and tasted like feet. And I had at this huge chocolate bar I got at Trader Joe's and didn't answer the door, even though I could see it was UPS. And the poem goes on, not endlessly, I hope.
When did you write that poem?
Well, it came from the actual beginning, where I'd been having a lot of abdominal pain so that I could hardly walk a block. And I got sent to a gastroenterologist, and he did a bunch of tests, and then the test came back to me, and it was all heart-related. So then it seemed like, yes, this thing that was hanging over me for quite some time was really, you know, asserting itself, and my heart was indeed failing, and something would have to be done, or the outlook wasn't good.
There's a letter that circulated amongst your friends and colleagues that was about your illness, and there was one particular detail that your heart was pumping only at about the 8% level.
Yeah, that was at its lowest. It was pretty dreary. Now whenever anybody sees me, they comment about how pink I look.
Yeah, nice blood to the cheeks.
Yeah, yeah. And who knows what the effect of having all this blood in my brain, if it will change my poetry. I hope it makes it better.
You know, it's also said of you, and this could be said of many poets, but I wonder how you take this one, that hearts come up a lot in your poems.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of times it's not just a metaphor. It's, for me, it's an actual concern because I've been living with this diagnosis for over 10 years. And my father died when he was 49 of heart problems. So it's been a sort of shadowy concern for me my whole life.
Well, there is another poem, speaking of hearts. Can I have you read Late Valentine?
We weren't exactly children again. Too many divorces, too many blood panels. But your leaning into me was a sleeping bird. Sure, there was no way to be careful enough. Even lightning can go wrong, but when the smoke blows off, we can admire the work the fire's done, ironing out the wrinkles in favor of newer ones, ashy furrows like the folds in the brain that signal the switchbacks and reversals of our thought and just as brief. Your lips were song, your hair everywhere. Oh, unknowable fidgeting self, how little bother you were then, no more than a tangerine rind. Oh, unknowable other, how I loved your smell.
And that is a love poem to your wife.
Yes.
Your bride, really, right?
Yes, my bride.
Married.
Since November, late November, and most of it has been spent in the hospital.
What did she think of this poem?
I think she likes it. Hey, baby, what do you think of Late Valentine? She says it's very sweet.
Huh. Now, poetry, of course, isn't all memoir. Much comes from the imagination, but also much comes from real events. You are in a particular situation this last time while you've been on this list of people in need of new hearts. How did you manage to observe your life or somehow use your life artistically, even as you're staring really at your own possible death?
Well, I think that's one of the jobs of poets, is they stare at their own death, and through it they still see the world of 10,000 things. You know, poetry is about time running out to some extent. You know, you can think of that purely formally. The line ends, the stanza ends, and the poem itself ends. And I think one of the things that's so pleasurable about reading poetry rather than hearing it is that you immediately know where the poem's going to end. You can see it just in glancing at it. And there's something, and maybe reassuring about that.
The poems also deal with ideas of randomness and fate. I wonder if you could speak to those ideas as they relate in particular to receiving a new heart. Do you think about the 22-year-old student whose heart you now have?
Recovering from the surgery was such an undertaking. I'm just now sort of coming back into my head. You know, I just feel enormous gratitude. I mean, he gave me a heart, so I'm still alive. But I gave his heart a life, so it's still alive. And, you know, it's not a fair deal. I've been given this extraordinary gift. You know, we'll just see. I'm going to think about this person for the rest of my life.
Dean Young, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a real pleasure.
His new collection from Copper Canyon Press is Fall Higher. And on our website, npr.org, we're publishing for the first time a poem Dean Young wrote with his new heart. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.